Thank you very much, Bob. I have to apologize to everybody. I had misread the program and thought that we had to speak for an hour. I have cut my paper, and we're starting 5 minutes early, so I hope that I will adhere to my chair's strict schedule. According to the first century BC Chinese scholar Yang Xiong, quote, speech is the sound of the mind, calligraphy is the picture of the mind. There's a general scholarly consensus today that what sets a true writing system apart from other graphic semiotic systems is that a writing system allows its users to express whatever they wish. That is, it is the graphic analog of speech, and like speech, can encode any linguistic message that the mind originates. If we accept this definition of writing, then the question of antecedents is irrelevant, whether systems of clay tokens in the Neolithic Near East or pottery markings in Neolithic China or Egypt. True pristine writing systems appear first in Mesopotamia and Egypt in the last centuries of the 4th millennium BC, in China in the middle of the 2nd millennium, and in Mesoamerica among the pre-classic Maya at the beginning of our era. Relatively soon after their emergence, all of these systems possessed full-blown repertoires of glyphs and complex strategies for deploying them. Partial writing systems are not very useful, and when they existed, they were short-lived and left comparatively few traces, although I understand we'll hear more about these traces at this conference. Yet despite their early complexity, all four pristine writing systems initially functioned in a limited number of contexts, and centuries passed before they developed the flexibility to express whatever might come to their users' minds, to be, in Yang Xiong's words, a picture of the mind. But in another sense, the earliest writing was a picture of the mind. All four early systems, Sumerian, Egyptian, Chinese, and Mayan, were originally overwhelmingly, though not exclusively, pictographic. Of these, Sumerian and Chinese are the two that quickly lost most of their pictographic character. So you can see the evolution of cuneiform from relatively pictographic forms to very rapidly abstract schematic forms that bear little resemblance to the original pictograms. For Chinese, you have more or less the same kind of development. And note that as with cuneiform, even the earliest forms, the pictographic forms, are rather schematized. In contrast, both Egyptian and Mayan retained highly pictorial monumental scripts alongside more utilitarian cursives for the entire period they were used. So with Egyptian, for instance, the hieroglyphic script that was used for monumental purposes existed alongside at all times, even from the very beginning, more cursive hieratic forms that were used for more quotidian purposes. And with Maya, you have a similar phenomenon where you have many pictographic forms, even super pictographic forms of a sign, as well as very cursive forms that we find in, especially in the few Mayan codices that have survived. This retention of the pictographic form explains why written characters and figurative art are so alike in both Egyptian and Mayan, to the extent that glyphs can enter directly into pictures, as in this Egyptian offering scene or this scene from the Dresden Codex. Cuneiform, in contrast, forms an indifferent band alongside or cutting across a bas-relief composition, but never enters into it. And in the Chinese and related East Asian traditions, despite the intimate links of calligraphy and painting and the similarity of the brush strokes in the calligraphy and painting of a given artist, it is always clear, as it was in ancient Iraq, where writing ends and the picture begins. But if the earliest signs in all four systems were more or less stylized pictures, pure pictography is a dead end. The indispensable element that made each writing system possible was rebus-based phoneticism. That is, a character representing one word is used to write a homonym, another word with the same or similar sound but a different meaning. So in this simple rebus here, you use a hippopotamus to write hippo, but you mean happy, and a birdie for birthday, and female sheep for the second person personal pronoun. This is a little bit more complex. It is I believe, I can read Plato. I believe I can read Plato. While present very early in all four systems, rebus phoneticism plays a much more important role in early Chinese writing than it does in early Sumerian. Well over 90% of modern Chinese characters are compounds made up of a semantic element and a phonetic element. Although some of these compounds have traditionally been analyzed as having two semantic elements, recent scholarship, and I realize this is somewhat controversial, tends to see one of the two as being originally phonetic in function, even if it has some semantic character as well. In the earliest Chinese texts, the Shang Oracle inscriptions from around 1200 BC, perhaps 50% of the characters were already semantic plus phonetic compounds. In archaic Sumerian texts, rebus phoneticism was known, most of us believe, but rarely used, or at least it is difficult to recognize. Compound signs, when we can analyze them, are semantic plus semantic compounds. The semantic plus phonetic compounds that appear several centuries later are rare and uncertain in the archaic texts. So an example is the sign for head with some markings later becomes the sign for mouth. And then you have combinations of, for instance, head or later mouth plus food or rations to mean to eat or to give to eat, to supply with rations, or combined with water in a slightly later period, mouth plus water meaning to drink or to give to drink. Compounds of semantic plus phonetic, like mouth plus the sign used phonetically, may, for the word tongue, ma, don't really appear, or at least are not uncontroversially in Sumerian until after the earliest period of Sumerian writing. Archaic cuneiform also developed a system of semantic determinatives that could be placed before or after a given sign as a clue to its meaning. So, for example, you have the sign for shrine or cult place with a fish in it, and when it's preceded by the determinative, unread in when reading the text, for God, it's the goddess Nanshe, and when it's followed by the determinative for place, it's read as the city, and now we read this Nigen or Niemen rather than Sirara, which is the city of the goddess Nanshe. But these determinatives are fewer in number than their Chinese counterparts and are used inconsistently in archaic texts and even later. Compound signs are not nearly as pervasive in Sumerian as they are in Chinese. Like the earliest Chinese writing, archaic Sumerian used pictograms not only for the word designating the object they pictured, but for words that could in various ways be associated with the object pictured. Thus, the sign ka, mouth, itself derived from the sign for head, with the addition of two small lines where the mouth would be on the head, is used to write zu, tooth, inim, word, gu, voice, and du, to speak. Nothing but context differentiates these various meanings. One could say that the sign ka is an ideogram standing for a variety of notions having to do with the mouth and its functions. But this is only true in an abstract and decontextualized sense. In context, ka is always intended to mean just one of these. A Sumerian sign may be an ideogram, but Sumerian writing is not ideographic. It is logographic, and later logosyllabic or logophonetic. Any ambiguity rests with the reader, especially the modern reader, not with the writer, who is never using a given sign to express an idea or a vague notion, but always intends to write a specific word in the Sumerian language. The same was true for archaic Chinese, but very early on, Chinese writing began to disambiguate its polysema signs by joining them with characters used as rebus writings to indicate their pronunciation. Hence the standard semantic plus phonetic Chinese compound character. As this practice became consistently applied, there was no longer any ambiguity at all for the reader. The readings and meanings of each Chinese character are distinct, although I've been told that this isn't always true. Another kind of ambiguity in the Sumerian writing system will, however, be familiar to Chinese. There are an enormous number of homophones in Sumerian. The illustration shows four archaic signs with completely different meanings, all read gu. But also, notice at the top right of the illustration, the transcription du 11 for the verb to speak. The index number 11 lets you know that there are at least 10 other signs that can be read do. In fact, there are closer to 20. This rampant homophony has led many scholars to assume that Sumerian, like modern Chinese, was a tone language. Also, some of the homophony is caused by the fact that syllable final consonants drop, which happened also in Chinese, unless they are followed by a vocalic affix. Thus, du 11 to speak is really dug. But as in Chinese, neither tone nor original final consonants can account for all of the homophony. The essential nature of both Chinese and Sumerian writing was fixed by the choices made in their archaic stages. Chinese compounded characters so that eventually each morpheme was represented by a distinct character. The morpheme character relationship is unambiguous, but the character inventory is very high. Sumerian, with only about 800 characters, is much more economical than Chinese, but many signs have more than one reading and meaning. This ambiguity is often resolved by context, but for a modern scholar, and perhaps even for an ancient Sumerian reader, it would still not be clear, to return to the illustrated example, if a text mentioning a large ka was referring to a large mouth, large tooth, or even large nose, which is also written with the ka sign. By 2500 BC, and more regularly in later stages of Sumerian, phonetic indicators could play a role in disambiguating the multivalent signs. Thus, inim plus the suffix a would be written ka ma and read inim ma, while du or dug plus the affix a would be written ka ga and read duga. But ka a could still be read either ka a or zu a. There was never a consistent system of phonetic or semantic determination, and the multivalence of Sumerian signs remained a permanent feature of the cuneiform writing system. If in their archaic stages rebus phoneticism played a far more important role in Chinese than in Sumerian, Sumerian eventually exploited the device to write the many grammatical affixes essential to full expression of the Sumerian language, to create semantic plus phonetic compounds, and to write certain lexemes completely phonetically. In the Chinese system, the full potential of rebus phonology was inhibited by the presence of a semantic component in each compound character, and a highly developed sense of what proper characters and proper writing should be. There are Chinese manuscripts from the early 2nd century BC that reveal a much more flexible orthographic practice, suggesting tendencies in the direction of phonetic writing, that is, omitting the semantic classifiers and characters. But this was a dead end, and by the end of the 1st century AD, the standards of Chinese writing and orthography still in use today were firmly in place. In Sumerian, the phonetic elements in a spelling remained distinct and independent signs, leaving the way free for the further development of phonetic writing. So if you see here in this example, take line 2, U-na-a-dug, the first three signs are phonetic, and the last is a logogram. And you can see that there's really no difference when you look at the text in the way the signs are written or combined or in their size. They all look the same. There are even a number of entire Sumerian texts written phonetically, but there is no trend in that direction. Sumerian writing remained logosyllabic. Lexemes were written with logograms. Excuse me. If someone could bring a glass of water up here, I would appreciate it. Lexemes were written with logograms, and grammatical affixes were written with signs used to express phonetic syllables. Chinese remained and remains today every bit as resistant to purely phonetic writing as was Sumerian. The force of tradition is only one reason for this resistance. The other is utility. Whereas phonetic writing systems, with their reduced inventory of signs, may be easier to learn, a logographic system, once mastered, can be easier to use. This is especially true for Chinese, where the reading process involves only character recognition and not the disambiguation of polysemous and polyphonic signs that the reader of Sumerian often has to perform. But even Sumerian logograms were clearly perceived by the ancients to be superior to phonetic writing for certain purposes. The Semitic Akkadian language of Babylonia and Assyria, which replaced Sumerian in Mesopotamia by the beginning of the 2nd millennium BC, was written with a mixture of Sumerian cuneiform signs used for their phonetic values and Sumerian logograms, which were read in Akkadian. The process somewhat resembles the way in which Japanese is written, with phonetic syllabograms and Chinese logograms, with the following differences. One, in most Akkadian texts, the vast majority of signs are used phonetically. Sumerian logograms are used only to write very common words like king or sheep or things like legal formulas and the names of months. Two, unlike Japanese writing, phonetically used syllabic signs in Akkadian text look just like the logographic sumerograms. So you can see that in Japanese, in a Japanese text, you can immediately pick out the Chinese signs, the kanji, from the two kana forms, which look far less busy and much more cursive. But in cuneiform, you don't have this difference at all. Most Akkadian texts are overwhelmingly phonetic. But in the first millennium BC, when scholars collected ritual, scientific, and divinatory texts into huge multi-tablet compendia, they wrote them almost entirely with logograms, that is, Sumerian signs read in Akkadian. The reason is clear to any student of these ancient tablets. Once you have mastered the logograms, you can read or scan the texts much more rapidly than if they had been written phonetically. So here, for instance, you can see immediately when the animal in question, here you have dog, and then you change to pig, and then you change to sheep, and then you change to ox. So you can see by scanning immediately where these various animals are by just looking for the logogram. So So just to acquaint you again with the ancient Near East before I go on, this is Mesopotamia, of course. The southern part is we call Sumer, the southern part of the south, the northern part of the south, Akkad, the entire south we call Babylonia. Uruk here is the place where the first earliest tablets were found, and soon after they appear all the way up here at Jemdet Nasser. And then this part of Mesopotamia up here is Assyria with the ancient capital Assur and the better known late capital of Nineveh. If it is relatively straightforward how the Sumerians and Chinese created their pictures of the mind, the reason why they found it necessary to do so is more controversial. In trying to answer this question, we must keep two things in mind. First, an enormous social investment is required to propagate and disseminate a writing system, especially one as complex as the Sumerian or Chinese. And any early writing system must have had a commensurate social utility. Second, the earliest examples of any writing system are not necessarily indicative of the original purpose for which the system was devised. Their survival is rather a function of the durability of the writing materials and the environment in which they have been preserved. Nor, for the same reason, are any preserved corpora of ancient inscriptions necessarily representative of the uses to which writing was put. In most ancient civilizations, writing materials were organic and perishable and did not survive. Egyptian papyri are the exception. They survived especially in mortuary contexts because burials were in the desert, whose dry environment favored their preservation. The same desert conditions are responsible for the remarkable preservation of medieval manuscripts and ancient mummies in the ruins and caves of Western China. Of our four pristine ancient civilizations, only Mesopotamia utilized a durable writing medium, clay tablets, for everyday purposes. We can be fairly certain, then, that the archaic tablets from Mesopotamia are representative of the uses to which writing was put by its Sumerian inventors, and this use was administrative. A picture is permanent. It can be stored and consulted and compared to other pictures. With the emergence of densely populated city-states and their attendant bureaucracies at Uruk and elsewhere in southern Mesopotamia in the late 4th millennium BC, increased organizational complexity posed serious problems in accountability. Some partial solutions to these problems immediately precede the appearance of writing, and we'll hear more about these from Bob later. A standardized system of measurements, seals with enough iconographic variability to enable the seals of individual users or bureaus to be distinguished, a system of differentiated tokens that may have been used for accounting, clay balls with enclosed tokens and seal impressions that could link specific individuals and transactions, and seal tablets with numerical notations. The archaic Sumerian writing system, which uses the basic principles of these other solutions, standardization, iconographic representation, symbolization of quantities and commodities, but links them to the representational power of natural language, was conceived as the solution to the still felt problems of accountability and information storage. This optimal solution to complex problems quickly assumed the standardization of sign form and tablet format that we know from our early texts and spread from Uruk to other southern Mesopotamian sites. Curiously, more than 500 years would pass before Sumerian writing was used for the religious or monumental texts that seem to appear quite soon after writing's invention in other ancient civilizations. But, excuse me, because of the durability of clay tablets, it is in Mesopotamia alone that we can hope to capture the contextual reality of writing's invention. That reality is the early city-state and its attendant bureaucratic organizations. Only the kinds of problems that would have arisen in the administration of increasingly complex bureaucratic organizations could have given rise to a solution as complex and ingenious as writing, and only the enormous advantages of efficiency, rationality, and depth of control conferred by writing on complex social or political organizations would justify the expense of supporting an educational system and the scribal professionals it produced. Once invented, of course, it is only a matter of time before writing is applied to other areas: religion, law, long-distance communication, technology, literature. But however soon writing is applied to these areas, and whatever advantages writing might bestow on each of them, I maintain that the Mesopotamian model of writing's birth from a bureaucratic matrix is valid for China as well. The hundreds of thousands of oracle bone inscriptions and fragments of Manyang that form the earliest corpus of Chinese writing should not lead us astray in our attempt to understand the emergence of writing in Shang, China. However important communion with the ancestors may have been, writing was not invented in China to facilitate divination. In fact, the oracle bones and shells were inscribed after the divination and attendant ceremonies were performed, and were kept as records of the divination. A record-keeping mentality has its origin in bureaucracy, and the divination records are simply an extension of bureaucratic record-keeping into the realm of state religion. There are rare bits of Shang writing with a brush, which implies that brush and ink were already the primary media for writing, and the primary writing surfaces must have been wood, bamboo, or silk. Indeed, the character for bound wood strip records, su, is even found in Shang inscriptions. So these are much later records, which, but you can see the two horizontal strings and then the vertical strips just, just as in the previous sign. The more durable oracle bones survived the millennia, but the perishable documents on wood, bamboo, or silk did not. Writing was invented in China to facilitate the organization of the Shang state, and only later, but not much later, applied to the sphere of religion in the form of divination records and to commemorative purposes, as in the inscriptions on some Shang bronzes. Before my chairman cuts me off, I think I should simply skip the best parts of the paper and move to the last couple of pages. In it, I try to make some points, such as raising the possibility that both classical Chinese and literary Sumerian were really literary languages and never resembled much the way people spoke in real life, and I talk about the structure of Sumerian and Chinese signs a bit more, and finally I talk about the spread of both cuneiform and Chinese writing to surrounding cultures, and especially about the very strong imprint of Chinese culture on both Japanese and Korean civilizations, and the continued use of Chinese writing within the writing systems of each of those countries. But for whatever reason, the imprint of Mesopotamian culture elsewhere in Western Asia was never as profound as the imprint of Chinese culture that spread with Chinese writing to Korea and Japan. Strong competing local cultures and even local scripts in Western Asia may be a partial explanation. Also, Sumero-Akkadian culture was never formalized and systematized as was Chinese culture. Great Mesopotamian sages were shadowy figures of the legendary past, with no disciples and usually no teachings. There were no figures remotely comparable to a Confucius or to a Lao Tzu. And there was no explicitly articulated doctrine. Even the literary scientific canon was a loosely constructed affair with no easily discernible ideology. Mesopotamian culture was neither as intellectually attractive nor as politically useful to other peoples as Chinese culture proved to be. In the early first millennium BC, the Aramaic language spread through Western Asia, first in Syria and then into Mesopotamia itself, as the result of movements of peoples and the mass deportations practiced by the Assyrians. Aramaic had a writing system of its own, the West Semitic alphabet, simpler and easier by far than cuneiform to learn and use. Local populations to the west of Mesopotamia stopped using cuneiform altogether, while in Mesopotamia itself, alphabetic Aramaic was used alongside cuneiform and Akkadian. Excuse me while I skip through the slides. Ah, just missed the last slide, which was showing a scribe writing both cuneiform and Aramaic, something familiar to all of my Assyriologist colleagues. Of the two kinds of pressures on cuneiform writing just described, linguistic pressure and the attractions of alphabetic writing, the first was never a problem in China. There were always plenty of Chinese speakers with no danger of being overwhelmed by speakers of other languages, and the diversity of Chinese dialects gave and still gives a logographic writing system where readers can pronounce characters in their own dialects distinct advantages over phonetic writing. By the time China was exposed to the alphabetic systems of the Indian subcontinent, Chinese writing and culture were so firmly intertwined that there seems to have never been any threat from that direction to the Chinese writing system. The danger of alphabetization has been greater in the modern period, but Chinese writing seems so integral to Chinese culture, and its Chinese dialects remain so diverse, that it is difficult to imagine any compensatory advantages that would tempt China to abandon its characters and adopt pinyin or any other alphabetic writing system. And if Chinese writing has been able to survive the global economy and the computer revolution, it will surely survive any conceivable future challenge that the millennia to come may offer. Thank you.